I have poured many thoughts on this topic into this document. I believe I got most of the references, but if I find corrections and omissions and problems, I will try to make sure that the slides get uploaded. Questions and comments are welcome. So what I want to talk about today is basically is going to touch on some of the things that we've already heard about from Kevin, but basically factorizes into three pieces. The first piece, of course, is why are we doing oscillation experiments? How are they done? Because how they are done is very much relevant to what we can extract from them. In a related way, one of the core pieces, ingredients to these measurements are neutrino nuclear scattering processes. So I need to tell you a little bit about what those processes are and what some of the various problems are there. And then I'll try to give you some concrete examples for where these processes have had issues or we see expect issues in oscillation experiments. I also wrote down at the bottom, I do focus on this through the lens of neutrino oscillation, but there's also a feedback loop of when you try to make a cross-section measurement, you're also sensitive to these processes. So you'll see sort of a parallel theme in some of these issues also to sort of achieve, you know, precision measurements in terms of cross-sections, you also care about some of these issues. Okay, so let's talk about neutrino oscillation a little bit. So here I've got my neutrino interaction diagram, and now I'm going to just switch it away and take a look at what happened before that neutrino showed up in my detector. So I assume how many people here want even, like, do people feel comfortable with neutrino oscillation parameters? Ah, good. Then I will go through the slides. Okay, so when I talk about neutrino oscillation, I'm talking about one particular neutrino is born of a particular flavor eigenstate, it travels, and over time it changes to another flavor eigenstate where it is then detected. The flavor eigenstates are therefore related by a mixing matrix to the mass eigenstates, and it's the interference between the mass and the flavor eigenstates that is neutrino oscillation. I'm going to use a series of pieces of jargon. I will try to identify it as I go, but I speak fast, so always ask questions. The first part is in this transition from one flavor to another, I can see two different effects. You know, if there was no oscillation, nu A would just keep cruising through space. But if there's oscillation, I'll go from one flavor of neutrino to a different flavor. And I'll see a corresponding deficit of my initial flavor. So the former is called appearance. I go from nu alpha to nu beta, and the subsequent one is disappearance. Nu alpha goes into nu alpha, but there's less nu alpha than we started with.
Sorry, I should be able to clarify my question. I didn't mean what does neutrino oscillations mean, but I meant what does your question mean?
Oh. This is a new, okay, so maybe it is I who need to learn to properly communicate with theorists. I'm sorry. Okay, so here's the oscillation probability that relates these mixing matrix elements to what we observe and the probability that this happens. The other key piece to this is not only do we have to care about these elements, but we also care about the relative mass splittings between the masses of the neutrinos involved. And this whole thing is sinusoidal. So the players for what we're going to talk about today are theta 1-2, theta 1-3, and theta 2-3. And they're sampled by a series of experiments. You have sort of four or five categories of experiments: solar reactor experiments, long baseline experiments, which are accelerator-based experiments, and atmospheric experiments. And some combination of these are sensitive to the mixing angles. We're sensitive to this complex phase delta CP through appearance experiments. And here's everybody's favorite factorization of U, which nicely shows these different sectors, and also shows other parameters that I largely ignore, which are the Majorana phases, because they cancel as soon as you attempt to look for the particular probability sandwich I showed a few slides back. Okay, so this is the current state of things right now. Here's what we know according to the PDG 2016 report. So the first thing that we see is that, of course, the mass splitting's 2-1, and this delta M squared absolute value, which I might usually refer to as 3-1 later in the talk, these are separated by orders of magnitude, 10 to the minus 5 versus 10 to the minus 3. So the first thing that happens is if I really want to look at the sector related to the second and the third mass splittings, I can pretty well separate that in my experiments. What we don't know, of course, is the ordering of the mass splittings. In particular, this one is listed as an absolute value, but you can see that the determination of theta 2-3 and theta 1-3 has some dependence on whether or not this parameter is greater than zero or less than zero. That is, the piece that has most of the electron neutrino component is that heavier or lighter on average. We're also curious if there's CP violation. What is the value of this CP phase? Okay, so I wanted to show one of the more recent slides showing the current knowledge to dig into the last parameter that I mentioned of interest. Now, my pet parameter is theta 2,3 right now because it's less well known than theta 1,3 and theta 1,2 and theta 1,3. I don't know that these results have really been widely disseminated, but these are new ice cube results that have significantly shrunk the contour from the blue here to this. And we can see that the atmospheric sector, both Super K and the ice cube experiments, these are large water Cherenkov detectors that sample very, very high energies, well, very high being, you know, 5 to average 25 GeV neutrinos. And the Super K experiment, which is a little bit lower than that, favor maximal mixing. This is compared to the accelerator-based experiments, T2K, Minos, which is atmospheric and a beamline-based experiment, and NOVA. And so we've got some tension in the value of delta M squared 3,2, and some tension a bit in theta 2,3. This tension, as I'll show a little bit later, is, at least as an experimentalist, I view this as a little bit weak. It's something to be mindful of when we're constructing our, thinking about how we analyze our data. But as you can see, like in many of the cases, the best fits are rather close to the contours. So I don't necessarily know if we're really in formal tension yet. Of course, we all want to know whether or not theta 2,3 is maximal. So theta 2,3 can have a maximal value of sine squared theta 2,3 of 0.5. Question is, do we live here? Do we live on either side of this? And if so, which side do we live on? So I mentioned some of the players here. In the case of probes of theta 2,3, you're largely talking about the following experiments, the accelerator-based and atmospheric-based ones that I introduced so far. Constraints on theta 1,3 have been really spectacular and have been driven by Diabay, Reno, and Double Show. There's a series of future experiments that are also planned. You've heard about Dune and Hyperkamiokande from earlier from Kevin's talk. There's a planned experiment to have an extensive infill of the South Pole called Pingu that would give us some more information at slightly lower energies that is not currently available in the ice cube analysis. And then finally, we have a reactor experiment, Juno, that's planned that is, has an interesting interplay of trying to determine the mass hierarchy from essentially the interference between those well-separated solar and atmospheric components. I should state my bias. I am a T2K collaborator, so much of what I'm going to show you is going to be framed through that. This is a nice slide I stole from another T2K collaborator, presented at Neutrino 2016. And it just gives you a nice way to see some of the oscillation probabilities that we consider. So we have this giant mess, and it's sensitive to lots of things, but here's sort of a leading order term of what things look like for us on T2K. And indeed, the oscillation probabilities have terms that basically, you know, for us, we're mostly worried about theta 1,3, theta 2,3, delta M squared 3,1. And then in NUI appearance, the system gets a lot more rich, right? So we start with something that has a leading order dependence on theta 1,3, but then brings in also subsequent dependence on theta 2,3, delta M squared 3,1, and sine delta. Sine delta is important because this is the piece that when I compare new E appearance to new E bar appearance, I can now see an asymmetry and I can maybe pick up some of the physics that's happening here. One of the big points I want to make, however, is that we're not measuring anything but sort of this sum total. So the first layer of degeneracy in all of these processes is that you want to do your best to try to isolate these different pieces. You get some information from disappearance experiments here and here to combine with this new E sample, and you get reactor constraints. And that's the thing that right now is allowing us to then make some kind of statements about sine delta. Of course, there's a little bit more. I've left out one piece, right? So as neutrinos travel through matter, we're also going to pick up an additional term that has a dependence on whether or not delta M squared 3,2 is positive. 3,1 is positive or negative. That'll give us sensitivity to the hierarchy, the ordering of the masses. So here's a quick run through to what this might look like for a realistic oscillation experiment. So It'd be very nice if we had a monoenergetic neutrino beam, and we could run at a couple fixed points, and we could just map out this oscillation probability. Fix L, fix E, we're done. Of course, this is our best attempt at trying to get a fixed neutrino energy beam. So here's the oscillation probabilities that I showed you on the previous page. Here you can see that there's a, if I sit at a fixed distance, now there are going to be a point where I get the most oscillation. And so if I compare that to the spectrum I have, I'll see a distortion to the spectrum that lets me extract the oscillation parameters. That's the simplified view. In the case of Nui appearance, I've got more complicated physics scenarios here. The NH stands for normal hierarchy, IH inverted hierarchy, and you can see that this probability is going to change based on all of these different variables moving in concert in some particular way. But I have a broad spectrum, so I'm not able to isolate exactly what's happening here to here from an oscillation probability standpoint. So the layers of degeneracy are happening at the level of the oscillation probability, and also happening in that I'm bringing in different samples of events. I care about Nui appearance, I care about new mu bar disappearance, and all these samples are coming in to try to tease out the different parameters here. One thing to keep in mind when we're trying to do this teasing out, of course, is that the initial sources are going to change. So especially as we go forward, I'm just showing you a neutrino source from T decay. But as we move forward, there's a slightly different anti-neutrino source. And there's even neutrino and anti-neutrino backgrounds to each of these components. So also from a flux standpoint, I have to worry about all of the pieces that are going into this if I'm going to fully disentangle an overall measurement of this rate. And of course, the neutrinos are going through a fixed distance. You're going to see this is also T decay snapshot, which is sort of a minimal distance of 295 kilometers. But other experiments, Nova and Dune, go a much larger distance. And if you looked at their Nui appearance probability, you'll see it'll really change. And you'll start to see really impressively different effects for normal and inverted hierarchy. And this is what gives Nova power to try to disentangle the mass hierarchy within its own data set from neutrinos and antineutrinos. Sorry, extra slide. OK, so this is another layer to this is that because, again, the oscillation probabilities has all these different effects, as I just alluded to, NOVA has some enhanced matter effect that they're trying to tease out from their own data. So this is a study that we did actually on T decay to try to just take a look at how well could you determine the hierarchy and what part of the phase space could you look at. We've got oscillation parameter degeneracy, so I'm looking at theta 2, 3 versus delta CP. And I can see that NOVA in the blue is going to be able to, if true delta CP is minus pi over 2, that's where I can see the best change, and I'm able to determine the mass hierarchy at, say, 90% level. That's the shaded gray. T decay has almost no matter effect. So as I showed on the previous page, I'm not really able to tease that out, so we have very minimal ability to do this. The combination of the two experiments does give you an additional window, which is this extra piece of gray phase space. So people are very interested in combinations of experiments, atmospheric and long baseline, long baseline, because it gives us additional complementarity through the different energy spectrums and different baselines to try to pick out these different pieces. So that's what I wanted to do to sort of introduce where we're at with neutrino physics. But I wanted to, for the experts or interested parties in the room, make a few comments that I feel like haven't been widely appreciated necessarily. So again, lovingly stolen from Hiro Tanaka at Neutrino 2016, because these slides were they were easiest for me to understand and frame. So where we are at now is both NOVA and T decay are seeing more Nui candidates than predicted. And in T decay's case, we've run with antineutrinos, and we're seeing fewer Nui candidates than predicted. The question is, ooh, does this tell us something about delta CP? It is true that if I take a look at my observed number of events, and I take a look at changing delta CP, I can see that the best way for me to enhance and suppress nu e versus nu e bar is, of course, to move things to minus pi over 2 in the case of the normal hierarchy. That's the best way for me to get this asymmetry. But how meaningful is it? So what we usually do to fight with these kinds of problems is to run a toy Monte Carlo. So we take different sets of true parameters. So here's a snapshot with two sets of true parameters, both normal hierarchy, minus pi over 2, and delta CP of 0. And so this table will show you what fraction where delta CP of zero would be excluded at 90% or at 2 sigma for these different cases. And so one important point is, even if the true parameter delta CP was zero with our current data set, with this, you know, toy Monte Carlo challenge that we've done, we could still say that we would exclude delta CP of zero sort of 10% of the time, right? Like, as our data sets increase in statistics and as we hammer down systematics, these shrink, and then we have a better estimation for what the true parameters are. But what this is showing you is that we still sort of have a pretty broad swath of flexibility in the statistics that we have to be able to allow this. And so the corollary to this, let me also explain this guy here. So this is a snapshot for what things would look like for minus pi over 2 normal hierarchy. Here's, you know, your mean delta chi squared, and then this shows you these different critical surfaces to show you the huge spread in the toys that we have that can give you these fluctuations, again, just sort of based on the statistics that you have. So the additional point here is, so the big takeaway I want to give you here is, you know, I think it's extremely important that TDK and NOVA are running right now, but if I'm going to say that we're really getting hints of delta CP, I would still caution people we're in early days yet here, and that because we can see these significant fluctuations, your fit is going to try to shove you towards maximal or non-maximal delta CP because it has such a big effect in the event rate, even though you're still dealing with statistical fluctuations. I hope Kevin will correct me if I've framed that not clearly. So I wanted to show another way of seeing this, which is another thing that we've been thinking about, and again, apologies for a little bit too much detail here, is that when we try to assess, all right, I want to integrate out all the dependents on other parameters to just get at delta CP. When I do that, I notice that I have sensitivity to something that I was a little surprised about. That is, I have to put in a prior distribution. Now, do I expect delta CP to be distributed flat in delta CP? Or do I expect it to be distributed flat in sine delta CP? Sine delta CP is what we measure. So you might want to have the measurement have sort of equal distribution in the sine of the angle versus just the angle. And that might give you a different inference about exactly where delta CP is going to end up based on how you chose to do that integration. So this is a bit of a subtle point, but I think it's worth keeping in mind that some of the conclusions we might be drawing now are going to be sensitive to these things. And in addition to many of the other things we have to worry about, we need to be a little bit thoughtful about what our prior assumptions should be. For us experimentalists, I think, you know, maybe we have a preference to understand this here in sine delta CP, since that's what we're trying to extract. Okay. So finally, I made a comment about, you know, tension or not tension in theta 2, 3. So this shows you a separation with an MCMC-based Bayesian analysis to take a look at if theta 2, 3 is less than 0.5 or greater than 0.5 or also consistent with maximal. And so here you can see this separation. And, you know, you sort of have, you know, you have some mild preference to have theta 2, 3 sitting in pi over 2. But there's still a substantial piece of probability space where I could be happily living in the other octant. So for this reason, I think it looks like the minimums within our best fit region are also relatively flat. So I think it's hard to say whether or not there really is tension between the experiments, given that there's a fair bit of freedom to have sort of these different parameter scenarios. But it does highlight, but separate from that, we are very interested in seeing what each experiment will get in its endgame. So that's what I wanted to say about standard oscillations. I felt Andre was able to touch on sort of a broader and more thoughtful view about non-standard effects. It's been a long time since I looked at this stuff, but I wanted to just touch on some of the parallels to pay attention to if you get excited about non-standard oscillation. So logistically, the sterile analyses have much of the same logistics as long baseline experiments. So looking for light sterile neutrinos, you'd look for some sort of oscillation appearance or disappearance, but at a shorter distance for the same energy. The setup and the experimental probes are pretty similar. So in much of the same things I'm going to talk about when we do an oscillation experiment with a near and a far detector, and extracting the oscillation probabilities, you have basically the same sets of problems. You have some oscillation probability that you're integrating over with some set of parameters underneath. One of the important differences is that a signal channel that you might not have thought about is, for sterile analyses, you use neutral current events, and you look for relative deficits of events that are sensitive only to the active flavors. Whereas when I'm talking about appearance and disappearance, I'm largely restricting myself to charge current. There's also been a thought in taking a look at what could happen here or here that could create interactions that would alter your understanding at the source or the detector through matter effects. And my understanding is that this is also heavily constrained by charged lepton data, so I'm also not going to discuss it. And there's overall interest in doing tests of whether or not the mixing matrix overall is unitary, which is, again, I think a statement of just what we can synthesize from the parameters we can get. So all signs point back to, all right, how do I understand an oscillation experiment and do the best job I can getting out an oscillation probability? Okay, so I'm going to now completely switch tacks and talk a little bit about neutrino nuclear scattering, since I don't know how many people feel comfortable with that topic. How many people feel comfortable with neutrino nuclear scattering? Awesome. Three people.
I'll re-ask the question. What does your question mean, though?
Yeah, that was a very poorly stated question. Nobody is comfortable with this topic. So I will still introduce it and try to get to all the details. But in case you were just like, gosh, I need something to read today, we have it here for you. There is a new paper on the archive, the Neutrino Scattering Experiment Theory Collaboration, new STEC white paper with many of the authors here in this room. Richard contributed, Pilar contributed, Gabe contributed, Andre contributed. Who am I missing? Maybe nobody. Awesome. Oh, me. If you're interested in this topic and more, please take a look at this paper. In this, I mentioned to Gil, we've written in some of our wish lists in there. I can't say it's all of the wish lists for sure, but certainly radiative corrections are mentioned in that paper as something that is definitely needed at multiple levels. If you're excited about this topic, there's a newsletter, and the information about signing up for that is in the backups. Okay, so when I talk about neutrino scattering, I basically consider reactor energies to be boring because it's something that you can calculate at the 1% level. So why would that keep me up at night? Instead, I'm focused on experiments that are trying to measure charge current appearance to detect flavor. Fine. But then that puts me up in a regime where I'm now sensitive to a whole host of things. In addition to charge current processes, we're also thinking about neutral current processes for non-standard oscillations. That's a signal channel. But these processes are also backgrounds for the experiments. Okay, so to start things off, we have our old friend, CCQE. So here's an oversimplified picture of this. The neutrino comes in, interacts with a nucleon in potential, kicks out maybe another nucleon, and we can tag the flavor of the interaction or the charge of the interaction to get neutrinos versus antineutrinos, or to look for disappearance or appearance. As I move up in energy transfer, I now get to a region where instead of just a single nucleon, I'm smacking into multiple nucleons in the potential. And this is what I'll call 2P2H or multinucleon processes. So I move even up, I start to have enough energy to produce a delta, and then I see a pion, a lepton, and some nuclear debris in the final state. Now, these processes can be signal or background, and I can have neutral current analogs of single pion production. I can also have coherent production of pions on the nucleus as a whole. I won't really speak too much about this because this has actually been one of the success stories of finally seeing experimental confirmation of this process and starting to get a grapple on the theory. I don't think it's done, but there's been really nice progress over the last few years. The heart of the problem goes back to the fact that neutrino decay and flight beams are not monoenergetic. Again, I wished I could do a neutrino experiment where I just picked out the energies, but I can't. So instead, I've now got a broad probe that is sensitive to this and even more. As the spread of the beam is larger than the nuclear effects, I'm now sensitive to them. And the other caveat here that Kevin mentioned is that in order for me to have reasonable and appreciable and, in fact, powerful statistical size samples, you need nuclear targets. We just can't scale anything else that would be single nucleon to the scale that we would need to get precision neutrino physics. So here's the first quiz of the meeting, which is take a look at this interaction. Is it CCQE? Is it CC1 pi? Is it 2P2H? Could be any of them. Even if I pick out the proton here, well, I could have lost a neutron here. This could be a pion that's somehow misreconstructed as a proton. This could be all kinds of things. The only thing I'm able to tell from this is the charge of this thing was negative and the charge of this thing was positive. So this highlights very nicely with sort of a TDK near detector cartoon example, the inherent how multiple processes become a problem for us, because all I can do is select particles in the final state, and I'm sensitive to what particles I didn't see, and that brings in other processes that are relevant.
It was a pion when you see the muon decay?
Yes, that is one of the handles that we can use at the end of the track. So this guy makes it here, you see a tiny little hit here, you can use that to separate it, but your detector is never perfect and there's efficiency issues, so you're always going to get migrations at some level. The TDK analysis does separate into this zero pi topology. So this guy, we said, this was not a pion. The DDX and the TPC was consistent with a proton. Fine. So you have some ability to separate a little bit better than that, but you basically hit this inherent barrier. Another complication for TDK is the fact that the near and the far detectors are dissimilar. So we've actually crafted our selection to try to make sure that we're mimicking to the degree that we can the selection at the far detectors, so that they're not picking up other creative sensitivity to the problems that we have through the selections that you're using.
Can't you also distinguish energy loss by proton and ion?
Yeah, so you put this all in, but you'll still have, I think our CC0 pi topology, so like how often you get true no pions in the event versus not is very high, it's like 90%. So you do very well at that. But even if I selected true topology like this, I would have all these processes. Yeah, this one is actually a pion. I don't.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. You asked the question, though. Yeah. The second bullet, like, it was a proton.
Yeah, I asked if, what would you guys call this? Would you think this is a what? So.
Yeah. Kendall, I don't know if you introduced jargon like 2P2H. It's probably not important for your talk.
I tried to, but I speak fast, so.
I encourage you not to.
Okay, yeah. So my point is that even though I might look at this diagram and say, I should just go and collect up the two nucleons in this final state, actually achieving this separation has both sort of detection level issues and also assumptions about the modeling that both lead us to basically have this kind of degeneracy for different processes. I don't know if this process actually came from a slightly higher energy from neutrino, practically speaking. Another way to see this is to take a look at what our oscillation analysis measures. So the rate at the far detector is going to be an integral over energy. And maybe I'll have some way of separating it in energy, but toss that aside for a minute. I need to integrate over the flux that I was sensitive to, any oscillation probability, all the cross-section processes that contribute, the relevant efficiency. And when I do that, then I get a rate. And so as Kevin mentioned, the flux uncertainties are something like 5%. 5 to 10%, depending on where you are. And the cross-section uncertainties are 10 to 20%. So you've always got the sloshing between whether or not you attributed what you measured in the rate between the flux, and was it, okay, did I measure a rate that was a little high because the flux was a little high, or was it because there's a little bit more of this process, right? It's always shifting back and forth because you're only measuring the integral. The second core piece is, of course, that I have to be careful with any assumptions I make between what I am inferring as my energy estimator and what the actual energy of the event is. I'll talk a little bit more about this later in the talk and some of the challenges there. I'll also talk about issues with efficiency. This also can make assumptions about exactly which process it was. So you can get coupling between these two terms as well. So what are we to do on oscillation experiments? Well, we can at least get some information by measuring a second rate without oscillation. This is what we call our near detector that is set close to the source that then doesn't have any appreciable oscillation contributing. And this is a powerful constraint, because even if I do shift things up with the flux and down with a cross-section or vice versa to conserve rate, it still does give me some information about the combination of those two pieces. But as, especially as we go into an era where we're talking about precision measurements, we need to be mindful of where the problems are. So the first is that we're doing an integral of this entire process, and so people love to, and I sometimes oversimplify this as just showing the cross-section times the flux times the efficiency. People say, oh, there's a cross-section, a flux, and an efficiency. These will just cancel in a ratio, and I'm done. Well, that doesn't work, because I'm integrating over the energy, over the probability, which depends upon energy. Kevin mentioned this. Another thing that we worry about in Newey appearance analyses is, of course, that we're looking for Newey appearance, but our near detector produced a predominantly muon neutrino beam. So we don't have very many electron neutrinos to start with. So you're sensitive to whether or not you understood differences in this cross-section versus this cross-section, since the near detector is constraining the flux on the cross-section according to muon neutrinos. I mentioned that we have different contributions of neutrinos and antineutrinos in all the different different configurations that we run in. So it's not easy to say, in the same way you have some mixing of other things, you always have to worry about some amount of antineutrino contribution in your neutrino sample and vice versa. There are also like other things that are maybe more experimental concerns, but there are differences in the flux at the near and the far detector due to their position in the beam line. And there's also differences in the detector response. Even in identical near detectors, the selection for NOVA, for example, has much larger backgrounds of interactions coming into the detector versus the far detector. And the far detector, since it's sitting above ground, has a higher cosmic ray background than the near detector, which is underground. And finally, we're basically always relying on a model to tell us that we got the association between true and reconstructed variables correct, right? Something has to tell me that when I go from my reconstructed information, that'll go back to some true information. And we have to find ways to really test that interplay fully.
Is there a correlation between the flux that's determined via cross-section and the cross-section you put in?
Yes. So we put it, so we start out with some prior knowledge of the cross-section model and some prior knowledge of the flux model. You run the fit, and then you have the right anticorrelations built in. So you get the correct modes. Again, all of this is prefaced on the fact that you had to have put in the right cross-section model and the right uncertainties on that cross-section model, and I'll show pitfalls that we've hit in a minute. Okay, so to say it a different way, this is a graphic I stole from Laura Fields, which I think frames the problem very nicely. You have all these different processes feeding into one measurement, right? You're sensitive to different processes like 2P2H or CCQE, you're sensitive to things happening to CCQE in the nuclear medium, you're sensitive to the free nucleon cross-section. And you're measuring all of this stuff all at once. And you also have to worry about, those were all just signal processes, what about background processes migrating in? So now let me show you a little bit about some of the data indications that the models that we have are not complete. So this work is nicely generated from the wonderfully named nuisance software, which if you're curious about, I have references in the backup to take a look at it. And what this software enables us to do is take a look at some of the latest neutrino interaction models and overlay them against data. And Gabe's probably going to talk to you a little bit about similar efforts within Genie to do some of these comparisons. So the problem with CC1Pi is I can go out and I can say, fine, I'm going to measure a muon and a pion in the final state. Maybe I'm able to get a nucleon, but for the results I'm going to show you, I don't have any extra information. And I'm starting to see problems with this process. And those problems could be problems with how we treat so-called final state interactions in the nucleus, reinteractions of the pions in the nucleus. It could be that the single nucleon model didn't work very well for the pion kinematics. It could be that we screwed up not just the delta piece, but the non-resonant backgrounds, or maybe I screwed up the part that is coupling to the delta. So how does the data look here? So first we're going to start with results from Miniboon, Miniboon, and Minerva. So now this is showing you the different muon kinematics, and there's a gray shaded band that I hope you can kind of see that shows you that you sort of have a roughly reasonable agreement as best as possible here in the muon kinematics. But then as soon as I take a look at the pion kinematics, I start to see some holes and disagreements between these different data sets. The two Miniboon data sets are showing CC1 pi is pi plus production versus pi zero production. So there's a little bit of confusion as to why this looks really terrible with respect to that, but we've got the pi zeros mostly okay. And then there's differences in energy between Minerva and Miniboon. And so if you dig deeper, and I guess I didn't include it, Callum has a nice plot which shows that even looking at the bubble chamber data, you aren't necessarily seeing amazing pion kinematic agreement with the models that we have. So we're just trying to get as many different windows as we can on these problems, but unfortunately, we're usually just finding more problems or finding out where the underlying model was possibly on shaky ground. So a bunch of us last year, maybe 11 months ago, sat down and tried to look at why we were having problems trying to fit quasi-elastic processes and the single pion pane I just showed you a minute ago. And I wanted to highlight how efficiency can couple to this. And this is also something that can affect oscillation measurements. So here I'm stealing from a wonderful TDK collaborator, Stephen Dolan, his nice plot showing just up what we call a particle gun. So you just put particles in your detector, and you just put events in a tightly forward going cone, and then you give them a nice loose cone. And you see that indeed the efficiency as a function of momentum, just based on this angular information, is then markedly different. And so these kinds of differences, when you have these wild model changes, this can very much change your assumed efficiency. And so this is something that may or may not be covered by the uncertainties that you have. So you have to be a bit mindful of making sure that you've got the right kinematic distributions. And this also is why everything that Gabe is doing is so important, because having a mechanism for us to get these things into a full simulation, since we typically use full simulations to calculate the efficiencies, is important for experimentalists. So I'm showing this not necessarily because it's your guys' job to help us calculate the efficiencies, but because people in this room, like Aaron and Gabe, have worked really, really hard to get us these models implemented, and then this circumvents this particular batch of problems. And the mechanisms for having these models also allow us to incorporate them fully into the machinery we use to do oscillation fits. So finally, I want to show you some details about why this neutrino interactions are important for oscillation experiments, and in particular, the impact of alternate models on oscillation physics. So as I mentioned earlier, oscillation depends upon energy, so I need an energy estimator. And there's sort of two on the market, depending on what kind of detector you have. Either I assume that the neutrino interaction was largely on an at-rest nucleon, and then I can reconstruct the neutrino energy just from this outgoing muon, given that I knew the incident neutrino direction, which is something that we do know pretty well. The other way I could estimate the energy would just be from muon information combined with summing over the hadronic state. And so this is the calorimetric approach, and this is the QE-based approach. Of course, as soon as you start to toss in reality, you start to see biases in these estimators. So I'm going to just focus on the QE estimator here. So here, if I look at the difference between this estimator and the true neutrino energy for TDK, I can see that indeed CCQE events largely are a peaked distribution, maybe with a small offset relative to not putting a binding energy in here. But as soon as I include some of these other processes that contribute to the topology, like multinucleon processes, I start to see that I have a population of events off-center from this that give me basically a feed-down effect of being at higher energy but looking like a lower energy event. So in a cartoon way, this affects the analysis in the following way. My near detector just sees a peaked distribution. So I've now got these extra multinucleon events, and they're slightly the wrong energy, but they're still basically piling up under here. This beam isn't narrow enough to separate those two distributions. So maybe this shifts it down or shifts it up, but that's also within the systematics associated to the flux. If I look at the far detector, however, now I'm dealing with oscillation, and that feed down has a marked effect. I'm now moving events into a region where I'm trying to extract out the oscillation probability. And so this cancellation doesn't work as beautifully as we might have wanted to believe. It'll only really work for overall normalizations, but not these kinds of energy smearing effects that we've got. being a calorimetric detector doesn't save you from this as well. There's just different sources of bias you have to worry about, like the particle kinematics in the final state and whether or not they're above or below threshold, or your response to different particle types, especially neutrons, which might be difficult to track in your detector that carry energy away. Okay, so how big of an effect is this? How should we start worrying about this? And so Pilar and collaborators have done some of the nicest work pushing us towards a framework where we think about these things. So here's a plot taking a look at one version is reality, and then the other is a fit to just an alternate data. And both are generated under the same true assumptions, but they carry different cross-section models. And what you can see is that you can get shifts, in this case, in theta 2, 3, just by switching the model, not the underlying physics. So this is the complete package that encapsulates some of the different issues I've raised that show you can get an uncertainty on this. The corollary to this effect, of course, is exactly what uncertainties you put in associated to the cross-section model and if they were the right way to parameterize it. This is where if we can do what we can to bolster the parameterizations and make them more robust, that's extremely important as well, because depending on the parameterization you're going to put into, you might get some effect like this because your data says, oh, yep, I can constrain that away. I totally know what that is. Don't worry about it. But it was because the parameterization was broken that you end up with a residual effect like this. Of course, one other nice thing that this particular study shows is that exactly what happens to the oscillation physics depends on who you ask. So even just picking a different model out of the hat, now I'm getting a very different effect on a different parameter, in this case, delta m squared. So I have to think very carefully about, you know, what effects I want to put in, what I think they will be, how large I think they will be, the right way to put them in so that I get the right effect, and how it should be parameterized or simplified for the oscillation analysis. And finally, of course, I do have to worry about which energy estimator I'm putting into this. So let me show you an example of one of the pitfalls that we've done. So we've followed Pilar's excellent example, and within T-decay, we do a series of so-called fake data studies where we take toy Monte Carlo, pick a different cross-section model. It could be something that is fully simulatable and reweightable. So we can take, Aaron gives us a weight for his work, and we go in and we change it. We simulate pseudo data according to that. You fit that at the near and the far detector. You do the full extrapolation. Or it could be we work with a theorist, and you guys give us a kinematic distribution. We smear it according to our detectors in the near and the far. We fit that. And then we do a fit. So this was an innocuously small 10 MeV effect that was changing the energy dependence of the QE model by not a whole lot. We rerun the oscillation analysis, and here is the fake data shown in black compared to the near detector prediction and the nominal MC. So I've just zoomed in to show you that there's just a little shift here in this distribution. And the first other takeaway from this plot is anytime we're doing comparisons, we definitely want to do comparisons where you take into account the full uncertainties. Because a chi by I, you might say, looks okay to me. It's just a fluffy little bunny. But it's not a fluffy little bunny. In fact, it's a rather vicious rabbit. And in this case, what we see is that if you go to the extended run, sort of three times the protons on target that we've requested from the PAC so far for T-decay, you can start to see significant bias. And this is important because, we're trying to get to percent-level uncertainties in these long baseline experiments. And we see a couple exciting effects. You know, we see shifts to delta CP. We see multiple minima in theta 2, 3. And we're seeing the bias you might expect for shifts in basically delta M squared. And so this kind of stuff is kind of frightening. But I mean, to me, it just shows that we need good mechanisms to get information from theory, test and see if this is something important to us that then leads us to either improve our uncertainties or address issues like this. So I think the question is, what exactly is the target? And this is where I think it's been challenging so far to have a clear roadmap, because the studies that have been done so far, you know, we're only really now getting to the point where we have sort of relatively easy ways to take effects, toss them in, and test them. And this hasn't necessarily been is something that everybody can do all the time. You know, the time scale for turnarounds on this stuff on TDK can take quite some time. I think we need to move towards a framework where we can really test it and say, ah, yes, this effect is important because it has this impact. Instead, we've got sort of other ways of understanding how important these issues are. So on TDK, our current systematic error budget is something like around the 5% level. But a significant bulk of this is coming from our neutrino interaction model. So that already shows you that this is an important place where we can improve the uncertainties. And a similar story is true of the NOVA-NUI appearance analysis. If we take a look at Dune, this shows you how long Dune needs to run versus the significance for seeing CP violation at 5 sigma for 50% of the phase space. And as I change the uncertainties on your new E appearance event rate that are uncorrelated with the near detector from 1 to 3%, you're seeing a shift of something like a factor of 2 of the runtime. So this already shows you that especially digging into any uncertainties that you believe are not constrained or understood at the near detector, you want to just get those as best you can, ideally at sort of the 1% level. So I think that at least sets a goal for what we're trying to aim for. So one of the biggest ones, and I think Kevin was exactly right, is electron-neutrino interactions versus muon-neutrino interactions are a huge pain. It's because it's very hard for us to, you produced a beam of muon neutrinos, you wanted to get as many muon neutrinos as possible, and as few electron neutrinos as possible. So in general, it's tough to make these measurements, and some tenacious people, like here on Minerva, but also on NOVA and TDK, have gone out and tried to do these measurements. Here, so this is basically the state of the art of these measurements done so far, and you see that we're sort of setting the scale for being sensitive to these effects at 15 to 30%, but we're worried about few percent effects. So this is where I think we really need to dig into understanding these calculations, you know, help very much welcome. Another thing that keeps me up at night are things that we're discounting right now that we probably want to think a bit more about as we move into the future. So examples of this are relatively rare processes. But ones that are also difficult to change to constrain at the near detector. So if I have a neutral current interaction and it's from a delta and it produces a nucleon and a photon in the final state, on TDK this is like 1% of our event rate. It's compared to the statistical uncertainties we have now, it's not such a big deal. but this is something that's really difficult to measure at the near detector because the near detector has all this crap raining down on it. It's very difficult to select out at these events. And these events are, you know, even harder to get at than the electron neutrino interactions. So this is an example of a process that's painful. And we thought, it's small. Who needs to worry about it? And so we sort of ignored it for a while until a theorist came along, Luis, and then a graduate student of Nieves, and Wang, and we took a look at this, and we're like, oh, our model is off by, you know, a factor of two. So there's another room for collaboration where if you guys think that there's something that is well known or that should just be sanity checked, it's probably worth us going through and checking to see, do we have anything that's just grossly wrong in this vein of things? Also along these lines, I know Richard back in the day did work on looking at anomalous photon production for Miniboon, yeah? And so is that something that we should just take a look at and see if it matters for anybody? Because it doesn't matter today, but at some point we might start worrying about it.
What is the theoretical error that you would claim, or that these authors have claimed, that single photon production?
On this, I believe their errors are driven, they're at sort of the 30% level, and they were driven by basically the couplings to the delta ingredients in their particular model. We assign 100% uncertainty because, you know, our model might just be completely busted and we have no data constraint, and right now we can eat that error. This is another example of something that's, you know, not something that I can say, yes, this is critical right now to do. It's not. It's just something that I see as a potential concern longer term to try to dig into and make sure that we've got complete or anything else of its ilk like it that's lurking.
I would emphasize again and not to pollute any of this discussion. Controversial mini-boon excess
Oh, okay.
The wave in excess does have a background that looks exactly like the signal, which is exactly these hard photon events. And you have to believe that you know that background, mm-hmm. compute it theoretically with better than 100% error in order to say that there is an excess, because no one has ever measured that background.
Okay. But that's, but see, that's a great example of something like, I don't know that we've thought about this for TDK. I don't, you know, we should think about it and just see it through to, is this a big deal or not a big deal? Because the one of the things that, like, and this is all very off the cuff, but so we probably should just talk later, but at least in this case, when Mini-Boon is digging out from this huge pile of muon neutrinos, like the electron neutrino component, the signal for TDK is just, the signal over background is huge. You just have a giant pile of electron neutrino events at the far detector, relatively speaking. So this has diminished the relative importance of this versus Mini-Boon. But it'd be nice to know that we don't, like when Luis compared his model to Mini-Boon, he looked at the prediction. He's like, oh, it's about the same. Cool. And then we did this comparison and we're like, oh, maybe we did this wrong.
Say this is a discovery of a sterile of something.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
since I've interrupted you, could I ask you briefly on the previous slide, the vertical axis, so the new EMU cross-sections are very different in principle, so we don't expect one exactly, but how many new EMUs versus new EMUs are there in this?
Oh, so can I punt this to Gabe or Kevin? Kevin, do you know how big this thing is, the sample?
Sorry, precisely the question was...
I don't expect this to be one. 0.0, right?
I'm sorry.
He's asking why is this not just like identically one, and I would say that's just a probably a function of the different.
I'm saying that it should not be one because there are neutrinos in the antineutrinos.
Yeah, it's the small, right? It's this the small contribution of the antineutrinos is part of it. Why it doesn't go to one at zero, I don't remember. It may just be the antineutrinos, I think, are ordered 10% of the sample.
Okay, thanks.
They tend to be higher energy than the neutrinos.
Okay. So one thing that I think is maybe this is a nuclear physics problem, but I'd like to mention it to this group. I think it's sort of closely related to what Kevin was talking about, although I could be off base, is we're also concerned about you have a signal where you have a pi zero is produced and it's hanging out and it decays to two photons and one of those photons gets eaten. Now you're again left with a single photon process. I think we also worry about those kinds of processes eating photons and then migrating events into our signal sample. A final caveat for all of these processes is I showed this for the neutrino and the antineutrino flux. Another thing to be fearful about for these backgrounds is thinking about how the different fluxes in neutrino and antineutrino modes might matter or interfere, induce artificial differences in your delta CP measurement. Okay, so I briefly wanted to mention some of the nice work happening for single nucleon form factors and why this is important. So here's the little cartoon again. You know, it'd be nice to be able to sort of isolate out what's happening on the free nucleon case. In TDK's case, until likely this analysis, we've had an ear detector selection that's been biased towards lower Q squared. So anytime we try to fit the super K sample, which has a higher Q squared population, we're basically trying to infer the entirety of the model from what we have just at the near detector. And so this is an example of sort of a low-level weakness in our analysis, where we worry about whether or not we've had enough freedom in this extrapolation from low Q squared to high Q squared. With improvements to the parameterizations in the oscillation analysis this year, I can't show you anything yet, but we've done those improvements in two ways. One, we're going to go through and do some of the fake data testing with the Z expansion model and say, okay, how big of an issue is this, and try to put it in formally into the oscillation analysis. But first, we need to see, what does it do? So I hope that that's something we'll answer soon. And second, we've also, you know, this is also living in a soup of the nuclear piece. And so we've also made huge changes to that aspect of the program. And that's one reason where it's like, well, we're bringing this in and that's good, but the other pieces are also changing. And just from a practical standpoint, it can be challenging for us to update everything at once and then still try to understand what it all means. So there can be good work going on, and I apologize for not being able to show it, but We are looking for ways for where, in this case, you know, if I had just assigned sort of an overall normalization or a fixed Q-squared dependence, much like was assumed by the fact that we had a single MAQE affected parameter, basically fixed how this extrapolation goes out in high Q-squared. But because of these differences, one wonders whether or not that was skewing things at lower Q-squared up into high Q-squared, and we'd like to see how much of an effect that has.
I have a question about the electromagnetic form factors. So Minibun was using, as far as I recall, an unpublished work by Borek et al.
Mm-hmm.
What are you using for the electromagnetic form factors? Is it the same?
So I might punt it to Kevin. I know that for a while we were using a dipole. We looked at non-dipole. We didn't see such a big effect in the analysis, but.
So I don't remember what we used. There was a big change between. So the
EVA 2002, I think, or something.
Yeah, so there was a big change in between 2002 and 2005, where big was maybe 10% at high Q squared. And then the subsequent BBVA versions have had very small changes associated with it.
This is more.
I think for mini boot energies, it probably didn't matter very much, I guess.
Because there's also more recent, you know, form factor measurements. We talked about this yesterday, actually. So
it would be very skeptical if any of that mattered in any significant level for me, right? I mean, they did huge violence.
No, I'm talking about actually at this analysis and going forward.
In like 2012, we tried to look into whether or not that, like we saw, oh yeah, we're using something that's a bit outdated. We didn't see a very big effect in the analysis.
So this is just using dipole models for the electric and magnetic form factors, or you don't know?
I should double check for what is currently underway now. But do you know, Kevin?
I'm talking about the community in general, you know. So there's
BBA 07.
BBA 07. So okay, or whatever. So I don't know if these things were even published, but it was published. Okay, so I don't remember exactly.
It may not be published in your journal of choice.
No. I'm saying so the things were just conference proceedings. So it was.
I think that was.
The reason I'm saying because the for LHC physics, there's something known as, you know, people extract PDFs. There's actually work that goes into these things and more professional. And it might not matter, actually. You can stick in the dipole and everything looks fine. But if you're aiming for precision, it would be nice to.
Yeah, nobody uses the dipole.
Standard is not dipole. Maybe I'm being just sarcastic. But what I'm trying to say is you know, having some kind of, you know, world data for form factors that you can use, maybe as opposed to some parameterization that I think it's usually done in-house by the Borek et al. So
there's some discussion in the white paper, so now you have.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm asking questions. I already downloaded the white paper, don't worry, but I'm saying read the white paper.
My intuition is that compared to many of the other things we're talking about, including just giving more freedom in the Z expansion, for example, to me those are bigger fish to fry.
Right.
Like, I don't think this is a big effect.
Yeah, I agree with Kendall, but, you know, that said, if somebody, you know, wants to take over and make more professional, as you say, vector form factor work, then, you know, by all means.
There is a professional job underway, and Aaron has set up things in Genie, for example, to put vector form factors, and encourage Gabriel D, who is just working on that, to finish that analysis.
And, you know, I would encourage, there are other generators that other people use, some of the work will propagate out from there. Like T2K uses new reference. Mm-hmm.
So. Okay.
But Gil's comment is very important.
Okay, so now I would like to check with the advisors. Do you need me to try to keep us back, get us back on schedule? Do you want 5 more slides or no more slides?
Yeah, I'm keen in terms of lunch. They're not worried. They're not worried,
The bistro is open until 2.
Perfect. Okay. Okay. So I'd like to give people a sample for some of the new kinds of measurements that are coming out now. Highlight some of the exciting work done in the neutrino interaction community to try to tackle these problems. As I said, we're measuring a giant sandwich of many different processes. But there's still creative ways you can project this pile of information to try to get new information out. And one of the nicest examples of this was from Minerva, which is a similar analysis done on NOVA. They're using their calorimetric detector to just step through in slices of Q0, Q3, the energy transfer, and the 3 momentum magnitude, so that as you change this, you start to slowly transition from sort of a QE enhanced region all the way up to starting to get inelastic pieces and on up. And what's nice about this particular measurement is, even though you know you can point to where the disagreements are, and maybe you can't say for sure exactly what's going on, you can still make some overall interesting statements about this, right? You can say, well, it's clear that we're getting some kinematic regions of our models wrong. And so maybe this is going to point to model development here and here, as it should. This is a really nice way to look at the problem in a new way. Some experimental limitations of this is having to put in generous uncertainties on, again, missing energy in the calorimeter, threshold effects, and neutrons. So another thing that people are thinking about is something that I believe I've called it transversity. We're calling them single transverse variables. I believe this might be a reuse of a word that's been true in other contexts. So let me try to describe what this is. It's the idea of using the neutrino direction and taking a look at the lepton plane and the outgoing proton plane. And then you can come up with a series of variables, basically one momentum difference and two angular differences that give you some sensitivity to the nuclear state. So I think we're going to start to see people moving towards semi-inclusive measurements, especially of the hadronic state, to see, OK, how does this compare to the models, where the models really haven't been maybe tested as heavily. I think that it'd be great to sort of see a movement towards semi-inclusive measurements from theory that we can implement and test against what we have in the generators. This has transferred the problem from that you have to be, when you do these analyses, you have to be very careful with some of the efficiencies and kinematics effects I've mentioned earlier. But you also start to worry about the fact that you've leveraged your understanding of this system a bit on the neutrino direction. So you have to be a bit thoughtful about your understanding of the incident neutrino source. There's other ways to take that idea of leveraging the flux in neutrino interactions and beyond. So on T decay, we have a detector that's actually designed to measure the neutrino direction. So as you change the neutrino direction, you go through these different modules. And as you step through these modules, the neutrino flux changes. And this is just due to the kinematics of our particular source. You can compare nearby detectors and infer a cross-section as a function of energy just by comparing these different fluxes. So this is nice, because this is a way to turn an absolute constraint of there's the flux and it's moving to now a differential measurement that's giving you essentially more information about the flux that lets you get more information about the cross section. This is similar to what's done essentially with an independent measurement like neutrino electron scattering that Kevin was talking about. There, if you're able to say, nope, the flux was really at this rate with a well-known cross section, suddenly that takes some of these other problems and reduces their impact in an analysis. I finally wanted to just do some shameless advertising for the extension to the work here on T decay, which is the idea of using a detector that samples many, many different fluxes to basically make a convolution which gives you a very narrow spectrum. So all along I've said, look, these multinucleon processes are just buried under a pile of CCQE processes. But if I'm able to sample many different fluxes, I'm able to start to separate out these processes. We're looking into whether or not we could do a first phase of this experiment. We could position the detector at a point that has an enhanced electron neutrino component to the beam. This would give you a much higher rate of electron neutrinos so that you could maybe achieve a high statistics electron neutrino measurement that could then be compared to, you know, what we need to pin the theory for electron neutrino, muon neutrino differences. Kevin made the point that, yeah, if you want to be popular with a bunch of neutrino experimentalists, find ways to beat down the electron neutrino, antineutrino, muon neutrino, muon antineutrino differences. We need to understand these. These are significant for Dune and Hyper-K. OK, so to summarize, I hope I've gotten you excited about oscillation physics. I hope that you've entered the theater of pain. I saw downstairs was the theater of ideas. This is the theater of pain, where neutrino nuclear effects and neutrino interactions cause me pain. So because it's painful, we want you to help. Then it won't be as painful. So we need help on many different topics. Kevin covered Newey scattering. I would reemphasize differences between electron and muon neutrinos is something that needs careful thought. We also need to, I think, continue to try to peel the onion of looking just at single nucleon knowledge, understanding if it's sufficient, get that in as nice spot as possible, and understand where does it need to be. I think being able to propagate some of these effects, you know, we'll soon have an answer for you guys of, oh, is this sufficient? Is this a big effect or not? Relative to what? I mean, now that it's been set up in that way, it should be easy for us to be able to respond with. It's highlighted the need for things that aren't direct, I need a calculation from you, but we do need mechanisms so that it's easy to have turnaround of, you guys come up with something that you want us to test, we can test whether or not where it goes, how big it should be, what's important to either motivate more work or, you know, put it to rest and check it off of our lists. I also wanted to sound a mild alarm, to just be mindful of other rare processes that we've just forgotten about, but that we might want to sit down and pay attention to as we go into this future era of precision physics. Thank you. So there's been really amazing work by a TDK collaborator to beat down and come up with maybe the first reasonable estimate for this piece. That is not included in these distributions. I think we're really eager to see that. Kevin is probably a little bit more up to date on some of the nitty gritty details, but I would say that there's been really nice, even achieving this was a bit of an achievement. People went back, they looked at implementations of the form factors, they went through and made some additional improvements, and suddenly this piece clicked into place. The fact that there's a difference in the outgoing pion spectrum makes us suspicious about, well, you need to think about exactly how we set up that system. I guess it motivates whether or not we really have properly implemented and properly vetted sort of semi-inclusive models. So, and we've also recently found, you know, as you dig into stuff like this, you also find things like bugs, right? So I certainly won't lay all the blame on the theory. I will also say that one of the best benefits of doing these kinds of checks is you find problems and then you fix them and things get better.
Do you have any interaction with Jefferson Lab on getting data, exchange of data?
Yeah, so that's something that we're trying to grow. So as I mentioned, there's this NewSTEC white paper. There's a section dedicated to, you know, what the benefits of electron scattering. A group of us are trying to find ways to have basically a joint collaboration with electron scattering experimentalists and neutrino scattering experimentalists. And the idea is that we might be able to take raw data from wide-angle acceptance detectors and compare it to the same models through an electron scattering interface, analogous to the neutrino scattering comparisons. There are problems at many layers to that collaboration, for all the way from a funding standpoint to a, you know, practical limitations, but I think we have to try, and I think that there's valuable information that also should come in the same way that you have this problem. So as soon as you see stuff like this, you think, okay, who can help me with this piece? Who can help me with this piece? And I think electron scattering data is another window on a different sandwich of these problems. But brought into that means we also need to be very careful of where the differences between electron scattering is and neutrino scattering, so that we don't naively declare victory only to have missed an effect because we just didn't think about those differences. That was a long-winded answer, but yeah.
Okay, so maybe we can wrap up, given that we are very late, and we come back at